Okay, good evening, Shavuot Tov, and welcome back to Parsha Perspectives for today. Thank you for your flexibility again in adjusting our schedule for this week. Baruch Hashem, the Mirtz Hashem, traveling for good things, so I appreciate your coming together this evening. Our Parsha series is generally sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, a family in memory of Becky's father, David Grossman, our learning is Leila Nishmas, David Ben Menachem Manush. Series is also sponsored by the Dykman family, a member of their daughter and sister, Daniela Rachabas Shalom Ezra, a special young woman whom we lost tragically at a young age. Our learning should be Le'ili Nishmas as well. This evening's shir is sponsored by Gitti Baskel, Le'ili Nishmas Menachem Mendel Ben, Rabbi Yosef, is Neshama Shev Aliyah. Thank you to all of our generous sponsors. And we have the privilege of beginning the fifth and final book of the Torah, Sefer Dvarim, page 938 in the Art Scroll Stone, Chumash. And this Sefer, this fifth book, is categorically different than the first four. Really the story of the Jewish people from the creation of the world that began Genesis, began Bereishis, all the way through the 42 journeys and travels and stops in the desert, the loss of Aaron, the loss of Miriam, and now on the brink, on the cusp of the loss of Moshe. We begin Sefer Dvarim with the Jewish people on the cusp, about to enter the land. And in our minds, we have 1/5. We got 20% of the Torah to go. We're only at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim. And that's true from a textual standpoint. We have all of Sefer Dvarim. But if you think about it and you put it in context, Sefer Dvarim is the monologue, the soliloquy. This is the great speech. If you think I give long drushes, if you think Shabbos Agadol, Shabbos Shuvah here are long, maybe arguably they are, they're nothing in comparison to this. Sefer Dvarim is all the drusha, the speech, the sermon of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's what he wants to leave them with. It is his message to the Jewish people. In fact, maybe we'll start with the end. What do I mean starting with the end? Not only because I'm afraid we won't get up to it, we never get to the second half or the back of the parsha, but I want to take you in Rabbi Sachs's Chumash, and in Rabbi Sachs's Chumash, all the way in the last page of the parsha, page 1245. Rabbi Sachs's commentary in a pasuk towards the end of the parsha really is an introduction, not only to the parsha, it's an introduction to Sefer Dvarim. The pasuk says, Perek Gimel pasuk Chaf Aleph, Ves Yoshua Tzivesi Ba'isa Ilei Mor, Einecha Ra'oseis Kosher Asa Hashem Lekechem L'Shnei Malachim Ha'ila, Ken Ya'asa Hashem L'chol Amam L'chos, Asher Ata Over Shama. This is the penultimate pasuk of the Parsha, which means the second to last pasuk. But I love that word, and you don't get to use it so often. And I want to impress you. So I said penultimate. So the pasuk says, you're all a lot more entertained when we do this in the morning than in the evening. Just want to say. So pasuk says, then you may each return to the land I've given you. And I charged Yoshua also at that time. Your own eyes have seen all that Hashem, your God, has done to these two kings. So will Hashem do to all the kingdoms into which you are about to cross. And then the final pasuk, lo tira'um, don't fear them. Don't be afraid. Ki Hashem Elokeichem hu ha'nilcham lachem. Don't worry about Hezbollah or Hamas. Don't worry about Iran. Don't even worry about the Houthis. Don't worry about the seven Canaanite nations. Don't worry about Amalek. Why? When do you have to worry? When you're going at it alone? When it's only you? And when you worry, what could be? But when Hashem Elokeichem, hu ha'nilcham lachem, when God is fighting for you and with you, and it's God's fight. We saw in Sefer Bamidbar, Torah told us that it's described, those who attack the Jewish people are as if they're attacking Hashem. We're fighting His war, and God never loses. God never loses, and that's why we can be confident. So the second last pasuk is Yehoshua Tzivesi. And I charged, I commanded Yehoshua. Again, who's speaking? This is Moshe. This is Moshe's monologue. Even Chazal, the Gemara, tells us that the style and the authority of Sefer Dvarim is different than the first four books. First four are Hashem dictating to Moshe, Moshe taking notes first on individual scrolls, and then as the events unfold, and Moshe records them, collecting them, combining them, sometimes in chronological order, according to many commentaries, often out of chronological order, all according to the thematic way Hashem wants His Torah communicated. Sefer Dvarim is different. It too is divine, in that we don't treat it having halachic status different than the first four books, but it represents Moshe's own words. It's Moshe's monologue. And here Moshe describes, Es Yehoshua Tzivesi, Ba'isa, in that time, I charge. There was a succession plan. There was a succession plan. There's a great book, very important book, which though it's now several years old, remains just as critical if you're building an organization or you care about it, Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. And he talks about the five levels of leadership. And the highest level of leadership is the type of leader who's more concerned with the cause, with the institution or the organization than they are with their legacy, with their honor, with their name. And the test he has of a level five leader, of the highest level leader, is do they plan, do they care about succession? Is the whole success, is it all intertwined with their identity, their name, their honor, their glory? Or was it never about them? It's all about the cause, the mission. And for the mission to continue, there needs to be a viable, there needs to be a succession plan. So Moshe Rabbeinu here describes the succession plan. In that time, when I was told I'm not getting in, I commanded Yoshua. I had a successor. I had a succession plan. So here Rabbi Sachs writes, by the end of the book of Numbers of Bamidbar, Moshe's career as a leader appeared to have come to its end. Moshe seemed to have achieved everything he was destined to achieve. For him, there would be no more battles to fight, no more miracles to perform, no more prayers to say on behalf of the people. It is what Moshe next that bears the mark of greatness. What Moshe does next. For the final month of his life, he stands before the assembled people and delivers the series of addresses we know as the Book of Devarim. In these addresses, he reviews the people's past. He foresees their future. He gives them laws. Some he has given them before in a different form. Others are new. He has delayed announcing them until the people are about to enter the land. Linking all these details of law and history into a single overarching vision, he teaches the people to see themselves as an Am Kadosh, a holy people, the only people whose sovereign and lawgiver is God himself. Moshe surely knows that some of his greatest achievements will not last forever. As he stands there delivering this final speech, giving that charge, telling them you're going to go into the land, and it's not going to be the way it has been. Until now, it's been sort of cushy. For 40 years, though you did make 42 stops that weren't easy, packing and unpacking, but you didn't have to worry about your security. Hashem protected. Anani covered the clouds of glory, and so on. You didn't have to worry about your food. You didn't have to work and earn a living, an income. You didn't worry about the markets and your portfolio and the fluctuation of the price of oil because the man just fell from the heaven. You didn't have to worry about your source of water because the merit of Miriam, the Be'er, the wells provided the water. What was their job? What did they do? They just sat and learned. They worked on themselves. They became not a family. They grew into a people, into a people. And now they're about to go into that land, and Moshe is worried and concerned. And this whole book, all of Sefer Devarim, is his caution, his mussar, both rebuke veiled, as it is at the beginning of our parsha, sometimes explicit and direct, but always with their best interest first. And Rabbi Sachs says, maybe this last month of his life, over which this speech is given, told you it's a long drasha, this last month is perhaps his crowning achievement, because he's really done with all of his achievements. But unlike others, he doesn't retire. He doesn't sit under a palm tree sipping pina coladas. He's not playing mahjong, golf, or tennis. He's not riding out his last days, even sitting and learning in a kollel, taking that time to himself. He is the quintessential paradigmatic. He is the leader of the Jewish people until his last day. He's never done. He's never finished. We see that in the names of the parashos. We'll get later in Sefer Devarim when we get to Nitzavim Vayelech. Moshe's Vayelech, Vayelech Moshe. On the last day of his life, he's still moving, he's still going, he's still active, he's still accomplishing. We retire from our profession, but we retire from our work, but we never retire from our meaning and from our purpose and from our mission, and Moshe demonstrates that. Moshe surely knows, Rabbi Sachs writes, some of his greatest achievements will not last forever. The people he has rescued will one day suffer exile persecution again. The next time, though, they will not have a Moshe to do miracles. So he plants a vision in their mind, hope in their hearts, a discipline in their deeds, and a strength in their souls that will never fade. When leaders become educators, they change lives. Yiddishkeit, with its acute concern for human dignity, favors leadership as education over leadership as power. And it began with Moshe at the end of his life. One of Moshe's final acts as a leader educator is to appoint his successor, Yoshua. It will be Yoshua, whom Moshe has nurtured and educated as his successor, who will lead the people across the Yarden into the promised land. Good leaders create followers. Great leaders create leaders. The paradigm case is Moshe. Rabbi Sachs famously delivered a speech where he actually coined that expression, that good leaders create followers, great leaders create leaders. He gave it at the Kinnas HaShluchim, when he was speaking at the annual gathering of Chabad Shluchim, and that's how he memorialized the Rebbe Zatzal. He said the Rebbe's greatness is that good leaders create followers, great leaders create leaders. When you unleash leaders, when you make leaders, and that's what Moshe was doing at the end of his life. When his achievements were complete, he turned and he pivoted to creating great leaders, Yehoshua among them, succession planning, of course, a great concern of his, and in that way demonstrating his tremendous, tremendous greatness. That is Rabbi Sachs's essential introduction to Sefer Dvarim. So let's go. Eila Dvarim. Now we go, that was the penultimate pasuk. We can say we covered almost the whole parsha. Got to the second to last pasuk. But now we go back to the beginning. Page 938. These are the words that Moshe spoke to all the Jewish people on the other side of the Yarden concerning the wilderness, concerning the Arava opposite the Sea of Reeds between Paran and Tophel, Lavan Chatziros, and Di Zahav. 11 days from this place to that. It was in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first of the month, when Moshe delivered this speech. Eile ha-dvarim. The Medrash already points out the irony we've mentioned before, that when God recruits Moshe to be the leader of the Jewish people, what does Moshe famously say? Lo ish dvarim anochi. I'm not a man of words. I'm not an orator. I don't speak well. I can't be your mouthpiece. Lo ish dvarim anochi. And here the man who was lo ish dvarim anochi, eile ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe. That same word, dvarim, Loish Dvarim, Eilaha Dvarim. That's not a coincidence, the same word. It says a lot about Moshe. We've spoken a lot about it in the past. But let's start with a Teferes Shloima, the Radamsker. And he says the following. Eilaha Dvarim Asher Dibar Moshe, Kosov Ba'orach HaChaim, not the Orach HaChaim HaKadosh, Ba'or HaChaim, Aderach Shomer B'Gemar, the Gemara Yuma, V'Dibarta Bom, V'Lo B'Dvarim B'Telem. When we say every day in our Shema, morning and evening, that when you're home, when you're on the road, while you're waking up, when you're going to sleep, v'dibarta bum. What's bum? What does bum refer to? Speak of them. What should always be on our lips? What are we always speaking about? V'dibarta bum. Torah. Speak about Hashem, speak about Amunah, speak about Torah. V'dibarta bum. Divrei Torah. Connection to Hashem. V'lo b'dvarim b'telem. Don't talk about narishkeit. Don't talk about silliness. Don't talk about small things. Certainly don't talk about people. The dibarta bum. Speak about things of significance. I'll just tell you as an aside, really it's yesterday's parsha, but we know Elamase, the final parsha of the book of Bamidbar, recounts the 42 stops, the journeys of the Jewish people. 42. 42 is bum. Beis Mem Beis is 42. The Degel Machan Ephraim quotes a Zayda, the Baal Shem Tov. Why do we count, why do we care, 42 stops? Because, said the Baal Shem Tov, every Jew is destined for our lives to be made up of 42 chapters. What was the story of our people was a precursor for each and every one of our personal story. And like we went through 42 journeys, stops, chapters, so to every individual, similarly and as well. We left Mitzrayim, we're born into the world. We enter the promised land, that's entering the promised land of the world to come. And in between, the Jewish people had 42 stops, and we have 42 stops. And that Degel Machan Ephraim, in the name of the Helig Baal Shem, that was quoted around the world by rabbis yesterday, as it is every year, beautiful. But my Rebbe, Rav Moshe Weinberger, quotes Reb Leibele Eger. Reb Leibele Eger says, V'dibarta bum. Bum is Beis Mem, 42. We have to speak about the 42 stops. Tell the story of Hashgacha Pratis. Tell the story of embracing your place and you are where you're meant to be. Don't live a life of randomness and chance, but talk about V'dibarta bum, says Reb Leibele Eger. V'dibarta bum. Tell your children and your friends and tell your family and tell others about your story, about the chapters of your life, about your journeys, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the oscillating narrative, the highs and the lows, and how Hashem was guiding every step of the way. Don't bury your story, and don't delete your story, and don't ignore your story, and don't move on from your story. But v'dibarta bum, it's a story that we tell over and over, like Hamanti Ki Adaber, We grow emuna when we speak, and when we tell our story to our children, to others, we empower, we enrich, we enable. But back to the Tefer Shleima. Hodia kasav ki ach ilah yu advar mashad diber Moshe Rabbeinu kol yomav me'atzmo. Levad advar mashad tziva Hashem, udvar ma'ele duam ki'im divrei Torah. So the Or HaChaim says, according to Gemara and Yuma, v'dibarta bom v'lo b'dvarim b'teilem, eila ha'dvarim, Moshe was always speaking divrei Torah. Moshe didn't talk about, you know, the Yankees out of first place, how many games, are they going to come back? Is Aaron Judge injured? He didn't talk about such narishkeit. Who would care about such things? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't care about such. Who would talk about such narishkeit? Will Judge be back? Will the Yankees come back? Are they toying with us again? No, who cares? So one, does the Tefer Shleima. Nobody saw what I just did there. Yesh lahafli. Hello, Moshe Rabbeinu, Olav Hashalom, Ben Shmonim Shana, Yekodim Shekibel HaTorah. How could you say this so definitively, so confidently, that Moshe, his whole life, never got caught up in a conversation of silliness, small things, narishkeit? How old was Moshe when he received the Torah? He was 80 years old. Umalach b'chush yamim rabim. Ve'echko yamav l'dibe rak divrei Torah. The first 80 years of his life, the first two-thirds of his life, how can you say he always and only ever spoke divrei Torah? He didn't receive the Torah. Torah wasn't given until he was 80. Achin ezeh unyan sod liyirei Hashem l'chosh ve'shmo. Says the Radamskar afa pishos k'madam divrei olam azeh. You're right, the first 80 years he was talking about things in this world. He was a shepherd. He's talking about the sheep, caring for them. Where are they? Midian. He's talking about the well. He's going home. He's growing up in a palace with Bisya, the daughter of Paro. He was living an ordinary life before he became the extraordinary Moshe. He was living a very pedestrian, mundane, before he was the one who transmitted the Torah. How can you say, v'dibarta bom v'lo b'dvar b'teila eila advar masher diber, he only ever spoke divrei Torah? The answer is, when your life is never mundane, when even the ordinary you elevate to extraordinary, when all that you do is endowed and imbued with the Or Ein Sof, with godliness, with a connection to the divine, when you see and feel and hear and you promote God in everything and everywhere, then v'dibarta bom v'lo b'dvarim b'teilim, your whole life is informed. We learn in Tanya. Tanya says, unlike others, there aren't three categories of life: mitzvah, avera, and reshus. Others say there's three categories. A mitzvah is a noble deed, a positive commandment. The daven mincha after the shir. It's a wonderful mitzvah. Avera, God forbid a person speaks lashon hara, eats non-kosher food, does something wrong. It's an avera, transgression. And then most others say there's a third category called reshus. You watch the World Cup. I don't even know if it's over, still going, the final. You watch the way. Is that a mitzvah or an avera? So before the Balatanya, you would have said neither. It's a reshus. There's no halach in Shulchan Aruch that addresses whether you could watch a game of the World Cup. You want to relax, recreation, you chop in a game, you're enjoying, big gazunt. It's a reshus. It's something you're allowed to do. Comes along the Alter Rebbe in Tanya and he says, there is no such thing as reshus. There's no third category. Everything you're doing is either bringing you closer to God or driving you further from Him. Everything we do is either repairing His world or damaging it. Everything we are doing is either fulfilling our mission and our why of why we're here or setting us back. You could watch the World Cup, and it's a mitzvah in your case. Again, not one of the Taryag 613, but meaning you need a break because then you're going to come back stronger. You're spending quality time with someone you care. Whatever the case is, you could do it in a way which is meaningful. You're rooting for a team that's incredibly pro-Israel and supporting the, whatever you'll come up with of why it's everything we do. Every act of eating and sleeping, everything that seems like it's neutral is never neutral. For the Alter Rebbe, there is no neutral. It's either positive or negative. It's a mitzvah, it's an avera. There is no reshus. It's either you're serving the tzad of Kedusha or the sitra achra, the other side, the dark side. Or you're either doing it out of ego or out of elokus, godliness. And that's how the Tefer Shleima explains and understands Moshe Rabbeinu his whole life, even long before he got the Torah. He still only ever spoke only ideas of Torah. How could you say that? Torah hadn't been given. The answer is Moshe intuited. He knew. Moshe lived a life that was so ascendant. He lived a life that was so elevated that everything he did was to connect and to come close to Hashem. The Rabbi Sacks, back to Rabbi Sacks in the beginning of the parasha. Di Zahav. Now, we know Rashi tells us that really Moshe is embedding generously and kindly, the fisha in divrei tochachos, Rashi says. Moshe begins his speech with a shtickle musr. Guys, you've messed up. We're here. We're on the cusp. We're going in. but it hasn't been a smooth sailing ride. It has not been easy raising you. We've had a lot of setbacks. But rather than be direct or explicit, rather embarrass them or fill them with shame, which is not useful, instead he alludes to, he gives a hint. So he references the places where those events took place. So Dizahav, what happened in Dizahav? Dizahav means die. The word die means enough, enough, genuk, enough. What's Zahav? Gold. Might there not be a subtle reference here to an episode which involved gold, namely the golden calf, Cheta Egel, the worst sin of the previous generation? On this slender basis, Chazal built a daring interpretation. Moshe, this dramatic rereading has been transformed into counsel for the defense. He says to Hashem, the people committed a sin, but it was you who gave them the opportunity and temptation. Without gold, they couldn't have made the calf. Who told them to ask their Egyptian neighbors for gold? You! This was not something they did for their own accord. Therefore, you must not blame them. Please instead, forgive them. So Moshe Rabbeinu is the first level 5 leader, good to great. Moshe Rabbeinu is also the first Jewish defense attorney. He's a fantastic defense attorney. Here we messed up, caught red-handed. There is no excuse, explanation, defense. But Moshe finds one nonetheless, namely, they couldn't have done the golden calf if you didn't give them gold. You're the one who told them to go to the Egyptian neighbor, knock on the door and get gold. We hear in this agadic passage one of the most striking and human motifs in rabbinic thought. It's called limud zchus, the act of judging favorably or arguing the case for the defense. It means placing a positive construction on events, pleading a cause, setting forth the case for mercy, or at least mitigating of the sentence. The sages arranged for this limud zchus to occur specifically on Shabbos Chazon. Such a beautiful insight of Rabbi Sacks. Rather than the way we usually begin to read Sefer Dvarim, which is that Moshe is giving Musar, Dizahav Cheta Egel. Instead, Chazal say, no, read it differently. Moshe is saying to Hashem, forgive them for that. Move on for that. Why? Because how did they get that gold? Because of you. You told them. So it's a limud zchus, the idea of limud zchus. Sometimes you have an halacha, you have great poskim who use halachic creativity and ingenuity to advance an argument and a defense because a segment of the community do a certain thing and we don't want to think the worst of them. So we come up with an explanation, a defense, even though it's not ideal, but it's a limud zchus, a limud zchus. We do this every time we're down the kafschus. You see somebody coming out of McDonald's, you say, they probably just needed the bathroom. They were getting a cup of coffee, a Diet Coke. I'm sure they didn't have a cheeseburger. It's a limud zchus, it's a limud zchus. Says Rabbi Sacks, it's not a coincidence that the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, which this Shabbos is, Chazon, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, the fifth book of the Torah begins with Moshe demonstrating and modeling a limud zchus. They introduce into their reading of the first verse of Dvarim, the parasha always read this time of year, a note of defense. It's true that the Jewish people sinned, nowhere more so than we made the golden calf. But don't blame them, said Moshe. They had gold only because you told them. Moshe, often the Jewish people's greatest critic, here becomes attorney for the defense. Thus, Chazal brought a note of hope into what otherwise might have been the Shabbos of despair. We are a self-critical people. Tanakh is the most self-critical of all national literatures. We know our failings, and there's something admirable about this honesty, but it must never leave us bereft of hope. Jewish leadership, as Chazal understood it, is about giving expression to love, respect, and even awe for the Jewish people, who, though it has come through an unparalleled history of suffering, still survives, still flourishes, still bears witness to the living God. We are not short of critics, internal and external. What we need by way of balance is the voice of those who are melamed zchus, who see our faults, but see our virtues also. The Kedushas Levi of Levi Yitzchak Berditchev, the famous Berditchever, Chassidish Rebbe, whose whole life was dedicated to seeing the good in the Jewish people. Seeing the good in the Jewish people, famous stories, so many. One, someone came in and complained, Rebbe, there's a man, his horse and buggy, he's fixing the tire of the buggy, he's wearing his talis and tefillin. Can you believe while he's davening, he's fixing his horse and buggy? So Kedushas Levi of Levi Yitzchak looked up to Hashem and he said, Hashem, look at your incredible children. Even while they fix a horse and buggy, they wear their talis and tefillin. Everything you could look at in one of two ways, ayin tov and ayin ra. Do we judge favorably? Do we see the good? Do we assume the best? Do we find a reason to judge favorably? or is it the opposite? Says Rabbi Sacks, Di Zahav, here this pasuk opens the fifth book of the Torah, not coincidentally Shabbos Chazon, just before Tisha B'Av, to tell us, follow the path of Moshe. Be malamed zchus, be a student of the Berditchever, see the good and judge favorably others. Rav Druk, in his Lavos Eish, Sefer Dvarim Lavos Eish came out only recently. So here he says the following, Di Zahav, the Mishkan, V'di Zahav, the Egel. The Sifri, the Medjer Sifri, says Di Zahav, gold. Gold is a reference to the Mishkan and the Egel. Now, I don't understand, says Rav Druk. I'll tell it to you outside, because we're already going to run out of time. Even though we got to the second to last pasuk. He says, I don't understand. This is supposed to be veiled criticism. I understand, we all understand, obviously, the criticism of the Chet Egel. What are you criticizing? The gold that was given for the Mishkan. But Vader in the Kabbalah Tocha, Zesha Nosnu Mizahav la Mishkan, Ma Mokam Yesh Lo Chicha Makach, Adraba, Zoi Maila Shanosnu Zav la Bnias Mishkan Lashem. This is something we should praise them for, that they gave their gold to the building of the tabernacle. So why in the same sense the Sifri says, Di Zahav, Moshe is referencing the place as a veiled allusion to two things they did wrong, gold for the Egel and the alacrity and zeal with which they gave the gold for the giving the gold to the Mishkan is a virtue. Where's the criticism? Listen to Rav Druk. Hanira lomar bebir ha'inyan inezabara muvan shala adam lesrachig mechaton kechoshe yuchal. Person should distance themselves from doing the wrong thing as much as possible. Achim kvar nichshal adam mechid rachman letzlan yesh beze shtei madregos yesh adam shenichshal bechid v'achar achid to yodeh shema she'asa zeh achid. Sometimes a person does something wrong and they admit it and they confess and they acknowledge it and they recognize it and they realize where they went wrong and they feel accountable and they're going to suffer the consequences. But they know they did something wrong. But sometimes the person tries to rationalize, justify, and explain, even fix, repair, and they're trying to live in two worlds. They're trying to dance at two weddings. Adam kaze gam la'achar shechata. Such a person, even after they fail, ein libo nokvo klal. They don't recognize, they don't acknowledge, they don't accept, they don't admit. Ki omnam asa eza davara af tekach holech vosa mitzvah masim tovim. What do? They try to balance it out. They try to offset it. They try to do something good right away in such a way that erases, in such a way that blurs, in such a way that allows them in their own mind to have a sort of cognitive dissonance and to pretend they never even did the wrong thing. If you compensate right away, so a person who is not entirely honest in business but gives a lot of tzedakah from it is able to somehow in their own mind feel better about the fact that they cut corners. As opposed to the person who says, made a mistake, I failed, I feel bad, I'm going to learn, I'm going to repair, I'm going to do it right, I'm not going to make that mistake again. This is what Eliyahu Navi criticized the Jewish people on Har Carmel. If you recall, the story in the book of Malachim. How long will you try to play both sides? You're trying to play both sides with God. You're on the inner circle with God, you love and you're loyal to God, but really you also ignore and you neglect and you worship other foreign things. How long are you going to try to play both sides? So Eliyahu's tochacha was that if you're going to get something wrong, acknowledge and admit you're wrong and then do what's right. But if you play both sides and you're confused and you try to live both personalities and both identities and play both sides, it's the inconsistency itself. The inconsistency itself is such a problem. Rav Shlomo Shvadron, the great Magid of Yerushalayim, explained this is what, let's take all the way back to the book of Bereishis. Rivka feels kicking, a lot of activity in her womb. And she's troubled, she's bothered. So she goes to consult. She goes to the Navi, she goes to the Beis Medrash, she goes to find out what's going on. And she's told, don't worry, shnei goyim bevitneich, there's two nations in your womb. And one's going to be great, the other's going to be a problem. And she leaves satisfied. And many commentaries wonder, I don't know, if you knew you were carrying an Esav, would you be so happy? Okay, so you're relieved to know it's twins. But one of those twins is running to get out into the house of idolatry. What satisfies her? Why is she relieved? So Shon Shwajan says, you know why? She thought she was pregnant with one child, but this one child had a split personality. This one child was incredibly inconsistent. This one child was going to be duplicitous and hypocritical, try to play both sides. And therefore she was afraid, because if you play both sides, you're a nobody. You stand for nothing. If you make wrong choices, but you do it with a certain level of a commitment, a consistency, a passion, if we can get you to turn around, you'll admit the mistake, and now you'll be passionate and consistent in the right direction. So when she finds out it's not one child with a split personality, it's not one duplicitous, hypocritical, inconsistent child, but it's two, she is relieved. And that's what he wants to suggest. V'di zahav l'mishkan, v'di zahav l'egel. She'atocha yakach she'yisro anos nezav gam l'b'ni yisa mishkan mas yisa egel. She'psicha ashtei ha'sifa mi'amatzav ha'garua b'yoser. You can't buy your way out of your mistakes unless you're donating to our expanded campus. In that case, we're more than happy to help you buy your way out of whatever you've done wrong. It has to be a big number, but we're willing to talk to you about it. But you can't buy your way out. If a person made a mistake, admit the mistake, own up to the mistake, repair the mistake, correct the mistake, and commit to not repeat the mistake. Separate and dependent apart from that, we have a notion of giving tzedakah. It's a very virtuous, beautiful thing. But don't think that you can live in both worlds. I'm going to cut corners. I'll be ruthless in business. I'll be not entirely honest. I won't have integrity, but I give a lot of tzedakah. As long as I give a lot of charity. You can't live on two sides. That was the di zahav, zahav l'mishkan, zahav l'egel. If you're giving the money to the mishkan for the mishkan, good. If you're giving the money to the mishkan to buy your way out of having done the egel, no good. Then it would be no good. So we go through all these places that represent the veiled rebuke of the things that have happened then. Brings us to Pasuk Yud Beis, top of page 942. Moshe is recounting. His soliloquy includes 40 years they've been journeying. Remember that almost all who left Egypt are no longer alive. The Dor Dei, the Dor HaMidbar, the generation of the desert, don't merit to live to go into the land. Those 20 and above die. They used to dig their own graves and lie in them, and every year more would not wake up till that last year when everyone who woke up knew that they were going to merit to go in. So Moshe is speaking to most at this point who did not live at all with him, and he's giving them a synopsis. He's recounting, you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you come from. So Moshe is taking them through a trip through Jewish history until that point. It's only been 40 years, but there's so many lessons to glean and learn from it that Moshe wants to remind them of it. So he begins, and he tells them, V'omar aleichem be'isahi, I told you lo uchal levadi se'is eschem, I can't on my own, I can't carry you, Hashem lokechem irbazchem v'inchem ayem kecho v'yashem ayem lorov, Hashem has made you multiply, there are so many, v'inchem ayem, Hashem lokei yavuzeichem v'yosef aleichem kechem el pamim, v'orech eschem kasher diber lachem, God has added 1,000 times, bless you as he has spoken, eicha esal levadi, tarchachem u'masachem v'rivchem, how can I alone carry your contentiousness, your burdens, your fights? Havu lachem anashim chachamin v'anim v'idiyim l'shevtechem v'asimim b'rasheichem. Here Moshe is remembering the advice of the Shver, of his father-in-law Yisro. When Yisro comes and he sees Moshe is wearing himself out, Moshe cannot do it all. Moshe needs EOS, delegate and elevate. Moshe needs to be able to pass the baton to others, include others, create a hierarchy and a system, and only have the hardest cases come to him. And Moshe is recounting how that happened. But in that context, he says, Eicha esal levadi, how can I do this alone? Tarchachem masachem uvirchem. This Shabbos, Shabbos Chazon, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, that word Eicha is reminiscent of Eicha that we'll read. Hopefully Mashiach will come and we won't. But if not, we'll read next week for Tisha B'Av. And we read it in the tune of Tisha B'Av. The Sefer Noam, Imre Noam, says on this pasuk, Eicha esal levadi, al derech shepirshu besvarim, he'asu v'agid alachem es ha'shikra eschem ba'achris ha'yamim. When Yaakov gathers his children to give them their blessing, he gathers them, at first his goal is to reveal what's going to happen in the end of days. What's going to happen in the eschatological era? Mashiach comes, the end of days, Geula. She'Yaakov tzivo osam ha'shalei muta rak l'rosh ha'yi b'neim achtos b'lev echad ki ish echad. But the prerequisite, the precursor to that, you'll only get merit to the end of days when what? When you experience unity, achtos. We know the destruction of two Batei Mikdash, Tisha B'Av, 9 days, the 3 weeks we're in, it's all because of Sinas Chinam. We know it, we learn it, we live it, and we keep repeating it. And we can't seem to solve it. Yaakov knew it when he warned his 12 sons, you're different. Each of you relate, connect to Hashem in your own way. Honor it, respect it. 12 separate tribes, but come together around my bed as one. Let my bed be whole and complete. Ba'asifa aguda achas. Azenikaram b'shem kineses Yisrael. Ve'azani amshich l'amagula asida. Then I'll tell you and reveal, when you demonstrate what you need to do and how you need to behave, then I'll tell you what will happen at the end of days. But it will depend first on your achdus. Kilo nechra v'yushalayim raka sinas chinam. So zeh, that's how you understand, says Dimri Noam, Eicha esa levadi. Moshe is telling them, Asher ma'asha tolei be'esa kachur ban ha-geula, anochi levadi esa zos. When it comes to the geula redemption, I got it. That's on me. Alai l'sakein hai eicha. I'll take care at the end of days, I'll take care of that promise being fulfilled, of Mashiach, of world peace, of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, bringing the geula, alai. That's on me. I got that. Eicha asa levadi levadi, that's on me. What's on you? Aleichem einu mutarak. You have to fix. Tarchachem masachem verivchem. Stop fighting. Stop calling names. Stop the ad hominem attacks. Stop dismissing one another. Stop judging unfavorably. Stop dividing. Stop. Stop already. Stop. Enough. Just stop already. Tarchachem masachem verivchem. That. So eicha. The eicha. That's on me, says Moshe. Beautiful, no? The Imre Noam. The Eicha, solving the Eicha. Yirmiyahu's Eicha, solving the Eicha. Esa levadi. I could take care of that alone, on my own, says Moshe. But Tarchachem, Masachem, Verivchem, I can't make you stop fighting. I can't. As parents, of course, all of your children are perfect. I'm not talking about you. But there are people whose children are imperfect. And as parents, you say, I'll take care of it all. I arrange the trip, I arrange the vacation. I arrange the family get-together. I'm hosting for Yontif. I got it. But I'm asking you, I can't make you stop fighting. I can't. I can encourage. I could teach. I can inspire. I can incentivize. I could try. But I can't make you stop. I'll take care of everything else. Everything else, I got. But you, tarchachem, masachem, verichem, just stop fighting. Stop fighting. I can't anymore. Just stop. And that's what Moshe is warning and telling. And here we are, thousands of years later, and we still haven't heeded the warning. We're still listening, but not learning. We're still suffering the same exact issue, where Moshe says, "The Eicha Esa Levadi." I got that. But Tarchachem Masachem, that, Yibrivchem, just stop fighting. Take responsibility. Avoid machlokis at all costs. Shalom for Charlotte. Drop the grudge. Figure out a way to get along. That's what we're going to talk about before Eicha, if we have to read it. So this year we're going to talk about that. Loving the people we really don't like. Loving fellow Jews that we really don't like. And this has become an issue. On October 8th, it was easy. Jews loved one another like never before, like nothing I ever saw in my lifetime. We were one, we were united, we were loving. We take a bullet, we go to the end of the earth. We saw only the good in one another, we felt united. And here we are, not even 3 years later. And the differences, they're important, they're significant. I'm not going to minimize the differences, the major ones people are arguing and debating over. But how we do it and what we're doing, how we speak, how we treat, what we're doing, the division that we're sowing, what we're causing. Is it any wonder Hashem says, no, until you figure it out, I'm not hosting you. I'm not moving back in with you. No. I told you about my hero who drove his kids to Disney in Orlando one break. And they were fighting the whole way, and he pulled in, he said, I'm telling you, one more fight, I'm turning around. I'm telling you. And he pulls into the parking lot of Disney, which is not a small expense, just the parking lot. And as he puts the car in park, another fight breaks out in the back seat. And without turning the car off, put the car in reverse and drove back to Boca. He's my hero. The rest of us, our kids call our bluff. They don't believe us. We give in. We didn't really mean it when we threatened it. He's my hero. For that and other reasons. He turned it around. So Hashem says, I want to take you away. I want to take you to the spiritual Disney. I want to host you. I want to play with you. I want to go on vacation with you. I want to take you away. Just, well, I got it. I'm going to cover the expenses. I'm going to make the arrangements. I got it. It's a little sign called Geula. All I need you to do for this incredible vacation called Geula, called redemption, just stop fighting. And we can't get our act together. And you know what everyone thinks? It's so true. My neighbor can't stop fighting. The other person. It's the other person. The other person. That's what we're going to talk about. Then that's the Eicha Esalavadi. That's what Moshe is communicating then. And really, he's still communicating to us now. Perek Beis, Pasuk Gimel. Penu Lachem Tzafona. Ua. Moshe is describing the journey. And he says, Vanefa Vanisamid Bariyak Yamsuf, we turned and we journeyed to the wilderness. We went through the Yamsuf. Kasher Dibra Hashem Elai, Venasavasar Sayyu Yamim Rabim. Vayom Hashem, and this is what God said, Rav Lachem, Sove Sahar Azeh, enough of your circling this mountain. Penu Lachem Tzafona. What does that word Tzafona mean? Time to head where? North. The word Tzafona means go north. Go north. But the word Tzafona can mean something else too. What else does the word Tzafona mean? Tzafun. What do we say at the end of the Seder? Tzafun. What is Tzafun? The Afikomen. Where is the Afikomen? It is hidden. Tzafun means hidden. And the Kli Yakar, I've quoted this before in the Parsha Shir, but I want to elaborate on it. The Kli Yakar writes, Shem Yimtza Isha Yisraeli Begolos, says the Kli Yakar of Lunshitz, there's a message for the Jew of exile, the Jew in the diaspora, how we're meant to live among our host nations. Listen, because maybe this is more relevant now than it's been in a long time. Shem Yimtza Isha Yisraeli Begolos, Hachala Zein Atzlacha Zer Sham, Yatminu V'yatzpinu Akol B'fnei Esav, Don't be flashy and don't flaunt. The word Tzafona means north. Tzafona means go into yourself. Hide your wealth. Don't live ostentatiously. Don't live in a flashy way. Don't show off. Don't take over. You know why? Because other nations are jealous of the Jews. And when you flaunt your success and your wealth and your influence, you're going to arouse their jealousy, their envy, their anger, their anti-Semitism. That's not to blame the victim. It's not our fault that it's happening. Doesn't mean you can't enjoy relatively nice things, but it's a question of how. Because, and here the Kli Yakar is trying to sort of offer a subconscious explanation of anti-Semitism. It all goes back to when our ancestor Yaakov stole the blessings from their ancestor Esav. Christendom, the exile we're in today, Galus Edom, are the spiritual descendants of Rome. Rome, Christendom is of Esav. So the exile we are in are the descendants of Esav. Yaakov and Esav, these twin brothers, Yaakov we know, Esav at least considered that Yaakov stole the brachos. Any success we have that other nations of the world are jealous of because they think we took it from them, they really deserve it, in a subconscious way, really goes all the way back to Yaakov and Esav. To Yaakov and Esav. And therefore, when the Torah says, Penu lachem tzafona, it doesn't mean geographically go north. It means hide your wealth, your influence, use it judiciously, carefully, modestly, be very careful. And the Kli Yakar then points us, and he says we have a precedent for this. When Yaakov sends his sons down to Egypt, he's got his sons, he's sending down 9, 10 sons. Yosef's already down there, Binyamin, he's holding back. He sends his sons down to Egypt, and he says, Vayomer Yaakov levanav lama tisra'u, why do you keep looking at one another? And Rashi there writes, what does that mean? He says, when you go in, be careful. When you go, these were 10 strapping, handsome, successful, charismatic, influential. Don't attract attention. Don't incite jealousy. Yaakov understood it in our descent into Egypt that began it all. And says the Kli Yakar, it remains true still today. It remains still true today. Marav Rabbi Rav Willig Shlita points out the Shulchan Aruch requires we leave a portion of our homes unfinished as a remembrance of the Churban. ostentation is incompatible with the proper perspective of our exiled status, even as it invites further jealousy on the part of Esav, and particularly Ishmael, who continue to despise and or attempt, sometimes successfully, to harm us. Conspicuous consumption causes disaster within Am Yisrael as well. It creates jealousy and begets hatred, the very cause of our lengthy exile. So modesty is an intrinsically desirable trait. Its opposite, flaunting one's wealth, is undesirable, even if there is no negative interpersonal consequence. And that's the caution, that's the warning the Kli Yakar has for us today. We once gave an entire shiur on this idea. The shiur was called Lay Low or Stand Proud, How Should Jews Behave in Gullus? On the one hand, we have to have influence in elections, determine who are our representatives, and use the influence that we have to make sure the right people who stand for our values get elected. We shouldn't be shy or apologetic. We should stand tall and proud for it and with it. My friends came back from Manhattan recently and showed a Jew who put outside their home proudly a sign that says, let's say, I'm a proud Jew. I'm proud to be a Jew. A sign outside their home in Manhattan, I'm proud to be a Jew. This is a time that we have to do that and stand tall and proud with it. But we also have to be careful. I spoke about, now's not the time to elaborate. I don't believe Jews outside of Israel should have sirens going off on Friday to say when Shabbos is beginning. That's for Yerushalayim. That's for Israel. That's not for Jewish neighborhoods in the diaspora. We're in the exile. We have neighbors. Not everybody wants to hear our siren on Erev Shabbos. We have to be careful. You can't walk down the golf course with your shtreimel. You can't cut through people's homes. That we have to be conscious and aware and mindful and sensitive what kind of attention that we're drawing. It doesn't mean you can't have nice things. We're entitled. We work hard. If we use it in the Balatanya's way, elokus, not ego, to get close to God, not further away, nothing wrong with enjoying and having those nice things. Don't flaunt them. Don't be ostentatious with them. Don't be insensitive and immodest. Don't flash them in people's faces. That's going to incite. The Pelayoetz, Orchaz Yosher, Kava Yosher, they had incredible traditions that the Jews of Spain were exiled because of Yabar Benel's wife. They had crazy traditions. She wore all of her jewelry at one point. Even if you have all your jewelry, should you wear it all at once? There's a din in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says, Hiskinu sha'orach shulchan lasa suda la'orchim, when you set your table, sha'isha osa tachshita yakesa bezav, or when a woman puts on her jewelry, mishayra min minei ha'tachshit sh'nayam k'dei sh'liya tachshit shalem. Don't wear every single, I don't know what it's called, every single jewelry, every single piece of jewelry you have, don't wear them all at once. When you set your table, don't empty the break front of every piece of silver you have at once. Why not? What's wrong? You look beautiful. It's the occasion. It demands it. Zok the Mishnah Bura says, you know why? Im yesh lahar b'minei tachshiten, lo tasem kulam ala b'basa achas, rak b'chol pam tishar achas l'zeichar ha'churban. V'nashem ha'miskashtos b'miloi gorma levad zeros rabas mi'umas ha'olam ha'miskanem b'hem. When we walk around flashing all that we have, people are going to notice, and it's not going to end well. It creates jealousy within and among the Jewish people, and it draws attention and creates jealousy from the non-Jews towards the Jewish people. And therefore, we have to be exceedingly and especially careful. Rav Chanan Wasserman, in his Kovet Shiurim, also writes, Hagorim l'shibosh zeh b'mdinasam, aydei negiyah shayisvurim, miskarvu l'agoyim l'shdavos lam tikatein senosan l'Yisrael. We thought if we get close to the non-Jews, if we live among them, if we live like them, if we have what they have, they're going to love us. V'to'u gam b'zato'uz gedola. Adrabba, ikar sibas hasim l'Yisro v'doraseinu v'nei sh'avarnu al'itzas avinu hazakein lama tisro v'dai l'mevin. Rav Chanan, who himself was a victim of such sin, of such hatred of our enemies, Rav Chanan warned us and cautioned us, and he was later a victim to it. We have to follow Yaakov, lama tisro v'dai l'mevin. Be careful. Be very careful. So we shouldn't get too comfortable. And we don't own the area. And if there are rules that dictate where you can congregate and gather and pray, we shouldn't feel so entitled, even if there are laws that could defend us. But if you're slamming car doors early in the morning for a minion in a home and a neighbor that's not zoned, you know, Jews have to be careful. We have to be sensitive. We have to be law-abiding. And we have to realize that we don't own wherever we are. Just because we live there doesn't mean we own the place. That's what the Kli Yakar is warning us. Pnu lachem tzafona means don't live like you own the place. Don't live like you own the place. That never ends well for the Jew. That's not to blame the victim. Chas v'shalom, we never blame the victim. But it's not Israel. You don't have an Erev Shabbos candle lighting siren going off for the world to hear. And there's zoning laws, Abide by the zoning laws. Don't think you're above the law and the world owes us. And not every neighbor wants you cutting through, walking like, be sensitive. Yes, we have rights, we stand for them, and this is that balance. We have to strike a balance. Surely we should strike a balance. We're no different than others. If there are rights to protect us, we should demand them, and we should stand up for them, and we're entitled to them. But just because we could all vote to take over a school board and redirect funding because we don't go to public school, that doesn't mean we should do that. That doesn't mean that's going to end well with our neighbors, non-Jews, and those who aren't observant Jews. Okay, that's the end of my diatribe on that. Okay, back to the Parsha. Back to the Parsha. Perek Aleph Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Oop, I'm skipping. I'm going backwards now. Aleph Lamed Zayin. Sorry, I'm going out of order. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's recounting the history, he tells them something somewhat peculiar from our perspective. Pasuk Lamed Zayin. He says we had the whole episode of the Meraglim. Who instigated the Meraglim? No, Hashem was taking us through. But you didn't believe in him, that even though he goes in front of you, to go see a place, and God heard you call out and cry out, and he swore saying, nobody's going in because of the Meraglim exception, with the exception of Kalev. So Moshe recounts the whole episode of the spies, the whole episode of the Meraglim. And then what does he throw in? Something that seems not only gratuitous, but inaccurate. He says, Gambi hisanaf Hashem biglachem lemor. And you know, God also got angry at me because of you. Because of what you did with these Meraglim, I also paid a price. Mile achare Hashem. Sorry. Agamatalo savosham. God said, you're also not going. Gambi yisanaf Hashem beglachem lemor. God got angry at me because of you also saying, Gamatalo savosham. Moshe, you're also not going in. Moshe, you're also not going in. God, because of the Jewish people. Is that accurate? Why did Moshe not lead the people into the land? Which episode? The rock. Nothing to do with the Meraglim. So why is Moshe blaming them? I also wasn't allowed to go in. Not only did you mess up with the Meraglim and none of you could go in except for Kalev, Gambi, he also wouldn't let me in, Biglachem, because of you. There's a lot that's fair to blame them for, but this is not one of them. How is this fair to blame? How is this fair to blame? So I don't know how much time we'll allow, but many interpretations of this. We'll start with Rav Soloveitchik. Says the Rav, no matter the reason for Moshe's death, one basic truth stands out. Moshe suffered an account of the children of Israel. Torah emphasizes several times, Hashem was also angry with me because of you. Yet in what regard was the people responsible for Moshe? If the sin consisted of hitting the rock instead of addressing it, Moshe himself was responsible. Same question applies to the other theories concerning the nature of Moshe's guilt. It was not the fault of the Jewish people that Moshe made a mistake, but had the people possessed a sensitivity and love for Moshe, similar to the love that Moshe felt for them, they would have torn the decree into shreds. When he was told he would not enter the land, Moshe pleaded for forgiveness. Had the people joined him in prayer, Hashem would have been forced to respond, but they didn't join. Says the Rav, what Moshe is telling them is, I always had your back. I davened, I prayed, I defended, I stood with you every time. I messed up once, and where were you? Had you stormed the heavens, as you protested Hashem, this wasn't fair to me, had you demanded I get to go in, Hashem would have had to answer in the positive, but you didn't. And therefore, Gambi hisanaf Hashem biglachem. It's because of you and your failed opportunity to protest, to storm Shamayim. In studying the chapters, writes the Rav, dealing with the last months of Moshe's life, we're confronted with the most touching tragedy, the tragedy of the teacher who was too great for his disciples, tragedy of the master who is too exalted for the generation. The disciples were not worthy of being Moshe's representatives. He had boundless knowledge, enormous depth and sweep, and unqualified morality and saintliness, but his students did not understand him. His singularity caused alienation. Of course, Yeshua, Elazar, and Pinchas received the Torah from Moshe. They carried on. Chazal taught that Moshe's countenance was like the sun. It radiated its own light. Yeshua was like the moon. It reflected light. Yet it was Moshe who was the teacher par excellence of the entire generation, which he delivered from bondage, particularly the generation which grew up in the desert, Why did not the whole nation believe with dignity, behave with dignity, humility, discipline, and perseverance? Why did they not act in Shittim with firmness, heroic resistance, determination? When the people made the golden calf, Moshe argued, what do you expect them to do? And the Rav goes on and on. Moshe was too great for the generation. He rose high above them. His vision was too penetrating. His depth superhuman. His sweep too high. They could not follow him. They failed to understand him. Had they understood and appreciated him, Moshe would have been admitted to the promised land. The people's guilt consisted of their not opening up to Moshe's influence in resisting his redemptive and cathartic power and not being willing to become his Talmidim. Of course, Moshe suffered the consequence. And that's how you understand why Moshe points a finger at them. That is how Rabbi Soloveitchik understands. Rabbi Sacks also weighs in on this, and Rabbi Sacks says a little bit differently. Rabbi Sacks says, how could the episode of the spies have been Moshe's fault? It wasn't he who proposed sending them. Ramban suggests Moshe was simply saying, like the spies and the people, he too was condemned to die in the wilderness. The Ramban understands the pasuk not connected to the Meraglim. Moshe wasn't saying it was your fault with the Meraglim that I didn't get to go in. He was just saying, just like you didn't get to go in, I didn't get to go in. But that doesn't explain the big lalchem because of you. So it says Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Sacks, alternatively, he was hinting that no one should be able to say that Moshe avoided the fate of the generation he led. Abarbanel offers a fascinating reading. Perhaps the reason Moshe and Aaron were not permitted to enter the land was not because of the episode of water on the rock of Kadesh. That is intended to distract attention from the real mistake. Aaron's real mistake was, anyone? Chet Egel. Moshe's mistake was the Meraglim. The hint of this is in Moshe's words here, because of you. Says the Abarbanel, it was exactly because of the Meraglim. Moshe should have discouraged them. And Aaron shouldn't have participated in the Chet Egel. But to distract from those two more egregious mistakes, the text as if attributes they're not entering the land to the Chet of the Mei Meriva. To the Chet of the Mei Meriva. What did he do wrong when it came to the spies? So Rabbi Sacks sends us back to what we learned in Parsha Shlach to begin with. You remember what we learned? The difference of Moshe, Hashem said, go, and he goes, Lasur, go be a tourist. They went, Laragel. They went in order to spy. Tourist sees the good. They went to see the bad. Where did Moshe fall out on that? That, says Rabbi Sacks, is what he was accountable for. Rav Drukin Lavasesh has a third approach. Rav Drukin Lavasesh. How could you blame Moshe? How could you blame Moshe? So he says, in Parshas Kisisa, Hashem told Moshe, God promised Moshe, you and the people will get up and go out and enter the land. That was a promise made to the people and Moshe. Hashem made a promise. So, how could God go back on his promise? Ella, you're supposed to go up with the people. Once the people failed to qualify, were unworthy, the Chet HaMeraglim undid Hashem's promise. They didn't keep their end of the bargain and nullified the agreement. Hashem didn't have to deliver the people. If he didn't have to deliver the people, he didn't have to deliver Moshe. So even with the mistake he did at Mei Meriva, even with the mistake of hitting the rock instead of speaking to it, Moshe, had the people merited to go in, he would have gone with them. But because they didn't merit to go in, therefore the promise to Moshe was nullified as well. And now he was disqualified because of the chait of the Mei Meriva. That is Rav Druk. We sort of Soloveitchik, Rabbi Sacks, Rav Druk. And now I want to give you my own. I'll close out by giving you my own original interpretation. My own original interpretation. Again, there's others too. The Kli Yakar, had they not been in the Midbar for 40 years, the episode of the Mei Meriva never would have happened. Meaning, had they gone directly in the way they were meant to, then they never would have had an episode where he hit the rock instead of speaking to it. The whole reason that that happened was why? Because the people messed up. So therefore, Gambi is Anaf Hashem Biglachem. Because you made a mistake that let us be there, it led to my mistake. But my mistake never would have happened if you hadn't first made yours. That is how the Kli Yakar understands it. That's how the Kli Yakar understands it. But I want to give you another suggestion. And there's not enough time to truly develop it. I wish there were. But I'll tell you like this. What was the mistake of the Meraglim? The mistake of the Rabbah. I'm going to try to give this in 3 minutes. It's hard because I could take an hour to tell it to you. What was the mistake of the Meraglim? These Meraglim were Anashim, Rashi says, Chashuvim. These were the Moetzas Gedolei Atayra. These were the greatest Rabbanim, the Gedolim of the generation who went to go investigate the land. How could it be they came back and messed up so badly? How could it be they came back and said, no, Hashem can't, the giants will never succeed? How could it be? How could it be? So my Rosh Hashiva from Keren V'Yavna, Rechaim Yaakov Goldwich, and the Sefer Asifas Marachas essentially develops the idea that they meant well, they were sincerely motivated, but misguided. What were we doing throughout the 40 years in the desert? It was a kola life and lifestyle. Until the point of the Meraglim, it wasn't yet 40 years, or much shorter than that, they got a taste of it. Moshe comes down from Har Sinai with the Torah, and the people are sitting and learning and growing, and everything is taken care of for them. They're being supported, they're being provided for, there's a police, an army, a judicial system, the food is falling from heaven, literally, to their doorstep. And these great leaders and men said, let's keep this going as long as possible. This should be permanently how we live. And that, he says, was their mistake. Because Hashem didn't give us the Torah for us to live that ascetic life permanently. He meant for us to take His Torah, to apply it and manifest it, and execute it and bring it to the world we live in. To set up a Jewish Torah-based society and government and police force and judicial system. That's the way we're meant to earn a living in a Torah-dic way. That it's not a concession to be a farmer, to work, to earn an income, to set up a society. Doing it based on Torah values is what we're meant to be, the bridge of heaven and earth, the physical and the spiritual. And the place that that happens more than any other is the land of Israel. Israel is the only place on earth that has what's called mitzvos hatiluyos ba'aretz. Ba'aretz. When you plant vegetables here in Chutz La'aretz, there's no halachas that apply to them. In Israel, trumas and maisos, you have to take the tithes. There are mitzvos, there's spirituality in the earth, in the dirt, in the dust. There's mitzvos tiluyos ba'aretz. Israel is a place where heaven meets earth. It's the place that we transform the physical to be the spiritual. That's what our life was meant to be in Israel. So yes, the 40 years in the desert were critical. And it's beautiful. Start life learning kolel, grow, form your home, spend time learning a kolel, but not permanently. We're meant to transition, to take the Torah we've learned, to execute in the life that we lead. And that's what we were meant to do in the land of Israel. Was Moshe the right leader to do that? The Maharal writes that the power of speech, why was it that Moshe had this speech impediment? Maharal says, in Gvuras Hashem, the Maharal writes, speech is the bridge of heaven and earth, physical and spiritual. Thoughts, how do we express and manifest our spiritual thoughts in the physical world? We speak them out. We say them. Speech. Moshe had a speech impediment because he was so spiritual, such a spiritual giant, so transcendent above the physical, the mundane, that he couldn't figure out the way to bridge the two. He had the speech impediment. When God first recruits him, He says, Kvad peh, kvad lashon, lo ish dvarim anochi, I am not your man, I don't speak well. Fast forward to Mei Meriva. God says to Moshe, let's see if you've learned the power of speech. Let's see if you've learned how to transform the physical into the spiritual. V'dibartem el ha-sela, speak to the rock. And what does Moshe do? He hits the rock. He still hasn't learned. Not because it's a failure, a fault. Because of his greatness, he's so spiritually great. He hasn't learned how to bring it down. He so therefore he still can't speak. So Hashem says to him, I'm not punishing you. It's not a punishment. But the generation are going to enter a land and they're going to set up an agricultural system, a judicial system, a police force, an army. They're going to set up a government. They're going to set up an economy. They need a leader who can live in the mundane. And if you still can't speak, then that's not you. And therefore you can't go into Israel not as a punishment, but simply as a description of reality. And maybe, this is one of my few original thoughts, very few, maybe that's what Moshe means. Gam bi yisanaf Hashem biglalchem. For the same reason that you made a mistake with the Meraglim, that you thought we could stay here forever, and you weren't ready to go into that place where we transform and elevate the physical to the spiritual, that was the same mistake I made. It's for that same reason. For that reason, I also can't go in. Rather than see it as totally unrelated, and why is Moshe bringing it up? It's exactly the same reason. The failure of Mei Meriva, the inability to speak, to connect the physical and the spiritual, the failure, even though well-intentioned, of the Meraglim, is the same failure of a Moshe of why he's not the one to bring them in, and therefore Gambi is anaf Hashem biglachem. Now we understand what he's saying. That's why I couldn't lead you in either. Thank you again for adjusting. We are on Wednesday as usual, Tanya and Living with Emuna. And Mitzvah Hashem, next week we're fully back on schedule. Have a wonderful day. May it be a week of Besoros Tovos, Yeshuas, Venachamos.